Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton take Florida in the state's key presidential primary. St. John's tops new county health rankings, but Duval drops. And the Florida-Georgia game stays in town for many more years to come. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. The show is always live at 9. Catch the daily podcast, too, on iTunes and Stitcher, and watch the show with our video on demand partners, TVJax.com and MetroJax.com. Just ahead, the top stories of the week with our Friday roundtable. Join the conversation right now. Get on the line at 549-2937. Then later, artist Shanique Smith and One Tank Trips will tell you about interesting places you can visit all around the area on just one tank of gas. All of that and more ahead this morning. But first, it's Friday and time for our weekly roundtable here today. Tim Gibbons, editor of the Jacksonville Business Journal.
Good to be here.
Good to see you. Andrew Pantazzi of the Florida Times-Union is here.
Good morning.
Fred Matthews, who blogs at The Examiner.
Good morning, Melissa.
Good morning. And Claire Goforth, editor at Folio Weekly.
Good morning.
Great to have all four of you here. A busy news week to discuss. Lots of big stories from new health rankings holding both good and bad news for Northeast Florida. To the Florida-Georgia game, inking a deal to stay in town for five more years at least. But first this morning, Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton victorious this week in Florida's key presidential primary, with Senator Marco Rubio not winning his home state. He dropped out. As the road ahead continues to the general election, we want your calls at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email and tweet the show or weigh in on Facebook. Fred Matthews, let's begin with you. Republican turnout was a lot higher in this state than Democratic turnout, as both Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, as expected, won the state, and as expected, Marco Rubio lost his home state. One veteran campaign strategist on the Republican side, Max Dipanovich, was quoted as saying, "Marco Rubio got clubbed like a baby seal." Your thoughts?
Well, he did manage to win, I count, about 10 precincts in Duval County. Despite all the other things, he did manage to get each out 10. His biggest, and in Duval County, he won the most votes in district, looks like precinct 8, where he handily beat Trump throughout all of this. And then, of course, a couple of precincts out of the beach voted for him. And even Ben Carson got one precinct out of the whole county.
Interesting.
For that.
Where
for
was that precinct?
That was precinct 808, again on the north side.
Okay.
He managed to eke out that with 40% of the vote. But, hey, it wasn't enough. It wasn't enough for Rubio, as we now see. And I think the numbers that came across the county with Trump basically getting 30, 40% throughout everywhere else in the county carried, and that's what we saw throughout the state.
549-2937 to join us. In Duval County, we had some glitches with the computers at our local precincts, although the supervisor of elections office worked through that. Claire Goforth, this morning on NPR, when a reporter talked to different voters around Florida, many are expressing dissatisfaction now with the choices on both sides if it does come down to a general election between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. Your thoughts?
Yes, I think the voters will be rather dissatisfied with those two choices. Hillary Clinton is a dynasty politician. People are a little tired of the same old thing, and she's perceived as the same old thing. I mean, but it is fair to point out that she would be the first woman president of the United States, which would be a very big deal. Donald Trump is so divisive. I mean, so many Republicans are just absolutely horrified by him leading this primary. And it just seems he's unstoppable. And even when he goes so far as to suggest that there will be riots if he doesn't get the nomination, it doesn't have any effect on his support. So I just don't know where we go from here.
Well, Tim Gibbons, go ahead.
Yeah, it does have an effect. It makes it higher, which is really the scary bit.
True.
It's like the idea that that is what his group of supporters want. The interesting bit's going to be, you talk about voter turnout, that Republican turnout much higher. He's bringing people into the party. As much as there's a great amount of energy around Bernie Sanders, you're not seeing that same groundswell of a bunch of new voters coming in. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out in the general.
And in the general election, could Trump depress voter turnout among Republicans, Andrew, that just don't feel comfortable voting for him?
I mean, I think it's still too early to tell. Trying to make correlations between primary voter turnout and general election voter turnout is a really tricky thing to do. So the Republican turnout in Jacksonville was 53%. The Democratic turnout in Jacksonville was 38%. But it's hard to tell what that means for the general election. So, for example, the Black Democratic base is more likely to vote in a general election than they are in the primary historically. At the same time, the Republican Party has three candidates who are very different. Someone who is very typically conservative, Ted Cruz. Someone who is a very atypical candidate whose policies don't match the Republican base in Donald Trump. And then now you have Governor Kasich, who is a very, you know, establishment-oriented governor. So each of those is drawing from different types of voters. So it's hard to tell if they will coalesce around one candidate or not. And I don't know if we will know that until the general election.
And Fred, we're also hearing there may be a movement to mount a third party challenge on the conservative side of the spectrum to Trump.
Well, I mean, anybody can do anything they want in the United States. That's the beauty of it all. You can come up with anything you want. But here's the system we have, and here's what the parties have created. That's why Bernie Sanders is not running as an independent. He's running as a Democrat. And that's why the Republicans put together the primary system they put together so they could coalesce around one candidate. And they have all run against Washington. So why would they be surprised that they end up with a candidate who's running against Washington and, in fact, is not in the Beltway? This is the house they created. They're going to have to live in it. And as Donald Trump has indicated to them, if he doesn't get the nomination, if there's some missive from the establishment to try to deny him that, not only will their convention be deadlocked, but they're going to be sitting in court. And imagine that spectacle come the fall.
And, you know, it's been so long since we've had a contested or quote-unquote brokered convention, about half a century, Claire, that people forget that it used to actually kind of be the norm in this country.
Yeah, but I don't think the voters are going to be willing to accept a brokered convention. The perception is that your vote counts, and if they do that, that's really going to go right in the face of that. And Fred makes it a perfect, he sums it up perfectly. The Republican Party has campaigned against Washington. They refuse to compromise. They've been doing this for how many years now, and now they have created the animal that is Donald Trump leading the primary. Now, where are they going to go from here? If he wins the nomination, I don't think he's going to be able to win the election. I just don't see the mainstream Americans going out and voting for Donald Trump. I think it's going to pull people in that wouldn't have voted normally, that want to vote against Donald Trump. I think you're going to see very high turnout among millennials to keep him out of the office. And the Republican Party, faced with yet another defeat, yet another term with a Democrat in the White House, may have to ask itself some serious questions about where it goes from here and how it starts to be more of a party of compromise and less of a party of radical ideas.
And looking at the idea of a brokered convention, we've never seen a brokered convention in the modern primary system for the Republican Party. So the way it used to be was you had these primaries, but that really didn't have much of an impact. I mean, you look at the Democratic Party in 68, in which their candidate didn't win a single state. The candidate they chose.
There also was riots there. I mean,
that's funny.
And could there be riots this year?
But looking at like the Republican Party, I mean, the closest analog we have would be 76 when Reagan had the popular vote, yet he only won one state. That was California. Mm-hmm. But back then, that was before we had primaries in every single state.
Yeah.
Now we've moved to this idea that the people decide, not the party.
You have to go all the way back to 1940 when it took six ballots for the GOP to settle on their candidate Wendell Willkie at their convention.
I find the irony interesting of just like the push to get rid of earmarks. The idea was this is good government that we have open primaries and everybody has their vote. And I'm not saying we should go back to smoke-filled rooms, but there is a certain amount of it's a party and party leaders controlling it is kind of, you know, works better for the good of the party, not necessarily for the good of democracy.
You're longing for the Martin Van Buren days party establishment?
Yes. Also, I think somebody should restart the Bull Moose Party just because that's an awesome name.
You can learn about the Bull Moose Party on PBS's The Roosevelts if you haven't watched that fabulous program by documentary filmmaker Ken Burns. Let's go to your calls right now at 549-2937. Let us know your thoughts about the results of the Florida primary this week and whatever else is on your mind. We will be discussing other news and notes from the week here on the show with our fabulous Friday Media Roundtable, Bob in St. Augustine. Hi, Bob. Good morning.
Hello. I'd just like to make a comment about the ascendancy of Trump. He represents he, to me, is the king of doublespeak. He speaks of bringing the people together, yet he has espoused the most divisiveness in this country I've ever seen in my 55 years. Racism is coming back. He talks about making the good deals, yet it's public, all his business failures. Now he's threatening the U.S. government. It's ridiculous. He is unworthy of the position he is running for, and it's a sad or a frightening commentary on the thought processes of those who would vote for him. He is totally unworthy. That's my comment. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob. Fred.
He's leading the greatest show on earth. It's one of the best shows you can see in politics this year. It is, again, what his party is voting for. It's what Duval County apparently voted for in just about every precinct except the ones that we looked at here. It was 46-33 all across the board, with the exception of those few precincts in District 8 and one or two in District in Precincts 14. I mean, that's what they're voting for, and this is what the people apparently want in their party. Now, you know, as Claire mentioned before, and as we all know, the Republican Party decided that this would be the path they are taking. And they're also willing to risk some Senate seats, by the way, this fall as a result of this debacle, because somebody's got to pay.
Well, the party establishment isn't willing to risk that. I mean, I think there's
genuine concern that the Republican Party could lose the Senate if Donald Trump is their standard bearer.
Because of the demographics. By dumping the two, and Cruz is again, not close to getting enough numbers to get the nomination. By dumping the two minority candidates that they had, which was the hope of the new generation for the Republican Party, they put themselves right back in the 1950s mode that apparently they aspire to.
And Matt in downtown Jacksonville. Go ahead, Matt.
Hi, I just heard you guys talking about the precincts. I'm an organizer with the Jacksonville for Bernie Sanders. I just wanted to know how he did as far as precincts in Duval. I'll take that.
Okay, thanks, Matt.
I've actually got that map up right now. So he only won a few precincts. Notably, he did not win Springfield, where his campaign headquarters were. He won, it looks like, three precincts in the Riverside-Avondale area. He lost 5 points. And then he won three precincts out near Atlantic Beach, and then one over kind of near Mayport area.
That gives you a sense of how the Democratic vote played out in Duval County. Stephanie in Jacksonville. Go ahead, Stephanie.
I was extremely disappointed by the offerings. I am a Republican. I've always voted Republican. But this time, mail-in ballot, I left it blank and put a sticky in there just to make sure that people knew that it wasn't accidentally unmarked. So that was my protest vote, and I don't know what I'm going to do in the fall. I think that we have a contest this fall between two egocentric political people who are out there for themselves and not out there for the people. So I don't know what I'm going to do this fall.
Will you vote or will you stay home?
Well, you know, it's not. If I stay home, then that automatically, you know, gives my vote to the Democrat side. If there was a third party, I think this year would be my third party vote. I'm not sure what I'll do, but I'm so upset. I'm ready to move somewhere. I don't know where.
Thanks, Stephanie.
That's what I find
once again calls to move to Canada. Tim and then Claire.
What I find fascinating about this, we talk kind of in academic terms about it splitting the party, but it's people like the caller who really have this. I mean, have some very conservative friends who very, very much they dislike the idea of Trump as much as liberals I know do, and the idea that they don't know what to do about it. They won't vote for Clinton, but it's like they can't
they can't bring
really
themselves
painful.
To vote for him.
Yeah.
Claire.
Yes, and I'll echo that. I'm married to a Republican, and he's horrified by all of this. One of the things about the Republican Party,
you guys must have some interesting talks.
We have had very many interesting discussions, Melissa. Some heated. The Republican Party in 2012 was 87% white. That does not reflect the nation's demographics, and that is a huge problem for the Republican Party. We're increasingly diverse, and I feel like this election is sort of that last call of the antiquated white conservative. They're terrified that they're losing their country. They have those bumper stickers, take America back, be American, make, you know, Donald Trump's slogan, make America great again. People say make America hate again is more accurate, but it just seems like what he's really appealing to is make America white again. He doesn't want to let Muslims into the country. He wants to build a wall between us and Mexico. A lot of his commentary does seem to be rooted in that racism.
Whether you agree with Claire's opinion or not, one study that I noted just this week, Andrew, was striking. For Donald Trump to win the general election, he will have to win the support of more than 60% of white males in this country. No Republican candidate in the modern era after Ronald Reagan has been able to do that. It's a high bar.
In 2012, Mitt Romney had a higher percentage of white voters than Ronald Reagan did in 1980 when he swept the country, trouncing Jimmy Carter. Now, he didn't surpass Ronald Reagan in 1984 when he had an even higher white voter turnout, but he did surpass him in 1980, and that wasn't enough for Governor Romney. So the idea is the number that you would need would have to be historical and
unprecedented.
Yeah, it would be unprecedented in how high it would have to be, the number of white voters, if you were not also getting a significant number of minority voters.
The entire idea behind the Rubio Cruz sort of, you know, let's have the Republican Party not be the party only of old white males, and that's not the direction
and
it's going.
And Ben Carson as well.
Right. Yeah, and the data shows clearly, I think it was pointed out by journalist Jorge Ramos this past week, when you dig deeper into the Latino vote, mm-hmm. they need, the candidate would have to get at least 33% of that vote in order to get there. The closest polls that Trump has at this point is about 16%, I think, on the Gallup side, and some showing 13. So he's not even close to where he would need to be in order to get the presidential, in order to win the presidency.
And here's a tweet from a listener. Why are you saying if there's a third party candidate? There are third parties, some with declared candidates. And he's right.
And I'll say about that, I spoke this week, I talked to a few super voters who've never missed an election ever. There was one guy who's voted Republican every time since like 1972. And he's already said he's voting Gary Johnson, the Libertarian candidate, and he's trying to get as many people as he can to vote for him. And I think you'll see that people who, since they've turned 18, have always voted Republican might start to, I'm not going to say like permanently disaffect, but are beginning to see that they're not going to just vote a party ticket down the line.
Haley in Mayport. Go ahead, Haley. Good morning.
Hi, yes. Actually, I have a question sort of related to what we were talking about earlier about a third-party candidate, but more in a sort of, I guess, conspiracy theory way.
We love that.
But maybe that the Republican establishment could rally behind another third-party candidate. Of course, the person that people are thinking about would be Mitt Romney. And, of course, when that person gets enough support from the people who wouldn't support Trump, it would split that vote, but it would also take away the votes from people who would have voted for Clinton, and then it would have to go to the Senate or to Congress.
It would go to the House, actually. Yeah, it would go to Paul Ryan.
Thank you.
All right, thanks, Haley. Okay, what about that? And also, let's point out when there's a credible third-party challenger, you can go back to Ross Perot's campaign. That tends to favor the other party. Perot's candidacy helped Bill Clinton win the White House.
But it depends on who that third-party candidate is. Right? That's why it was really interesting when Bloomberg said he wasn't going to run, because Bloomberg would have taken votes from Clinton, you know, even if he was running as some independent sort of thing. If you have a Trump-Kasich, you know, sort of third-party, yeah, pretty bad for the Republicans, but you're going to end up with a whole bunch of dissatisfied
Bernie Sanders supporters who won't necessarily vote for Clinton. So depending on who the third party is, who knows which way it breaks.
Is that settled, though? What do you think?
I think Tim makes an excellent point. I don't think that the Democratic Party is willing to risk losing the White House to Donald Trump. I think that Bernie Sanders is far too pragmatic.
I think those voters will come in line. I do.
I think they will.
Because of what you're saying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think what we're also seeing in the New York Times and other places, they've reported on discussion about Condoleezza Rice or someone like that as opposed to a Mitt Romney candidate. Which goes back to the idea of having a strong conservative minority candidate with credible experience in the executive branch of government. But still, I think that, the last time you can see a third party candidate doing well was a guy from Illinois named Abraham Lincoln.
Well, we could talk about this all day, but we do need to make note of some other news and notes from the week. Call us up with your thoughts about the top stories of the week at 549-2937. Also making headlines, a new study out this week finds St. John's is the healthiest county in Florida. However, Duval County is lagging, dropping to 48th out of 67 counties in the state in health outcomes. Not a good number at all. We're also 35th in Duval in health factors. Nassau and other counties much higher in the rankings, although Baker County is also in the bottom half of the state. This according to the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, using a variety of factors to look at the community's overall health. Tim Gibbons, our business editor, that's not good for business.
It is not, although it's good for business if you're trying to attract people to St. John's
sure.
County. Part of it, and I always find it interesting when the study comes out, yes, it's a health thing, but it really is a broad enough thing. Once you're including things like length of commute and economic, there's a bunch of economic factors in it. To a certain extent, what you're saying is St. John's County is wealthy and Duval County isn't. And, you know, money can't buy happiness, but it can buy health. So there's a slight disingenuousness here of it's not flat out just saying people are more healthy in St. John's County. It's basically saying they have more money.
And right. And I've seen that posted, Fred and Andrew, that when it comes to these rankings, health equals wealth.
Well, I don't think we have any doubt about it. That's why we have that's why Obamacare came into play. So more people would have access to health care, more people would have access to primary doctors, and they would have then be able to lower the instances of them going to emergency rooms and having all this. But the problem with this is still the same. We have an inordinate amount of folks under the poverty line in Duval County, and it's going to continue. The amount of venereal diseases is still not dropped to the level that it needs to. The level of HIV is still there, and in some cases, some demographics increasing. So, yes, health does equal wealth.
HIV, asthma, and a low birth weight among some newborn babies, all of these numbers in Duval County aren't good at all.
Yeah, and if you read this, so this is from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and their whole report is residential segregation is killing Americans. And what they're saying is that what we see are communities that are mostly white and wealthy, like St. John's County, have extremely higher health outcomes for all people, and communities that are segregated, like Duval County, where you have pockets of black communities that are cut off from services, you have people who are dying and people who are unhealthy, more likely to have asthma, more likely to be obese, more likely to have cancer, more likely to have diabetes than you are in communities that are more integrated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I do not know how demographically segregated Tampa and Miami and Orlando are, but I can tell you that I looked at Food Desert map to sort of look at the statistics, and Duval County has a very high number of food deserts, which is part of this problem, but so does Orlando and so does Miami, and they both place much higher. Miami was 6th, mm-hmm. Orlando was 12th, Tampa was 31st than Duval County does. Another issue we should discuss is mental health. Yesterday morning I was at an event and the representatives from the Baptist Network were talking about how every single hospital in their network said that mental health was one of the mm-hmm. major failings that they need to work on. Mental health is really crucial when it comes to physical health. And mm-hmm. another thing we should maybe think about here is Medicaid expansion. 800,000 Floridians don't have health care because we've refused to expand Medicaid because they're so-called able-bodied adults. is that what we want to do in this society? Just say, well, you're able-bodied, so sorry about your luck. No health care.
Joel in St. John's. Go ahead, Joel.
Hi. I was calling about the health disparity issue between St. John's and Duval. And I do believe, I think some of the focus from your panel there is on access to health care. And I do think that's true. As a resident of St. John's County, live in Julinden Creek Plantation, I also noticed the habits of people out here. I see a lot of people exercising, keeping their weight down, making good food choices. So I'm not disputing the fact that access to health care is a factor. But when you talk about wealth and health, it's not just the ability to afford health care. It's also, I think, the habits that come with people that kind of, you know, end up in St. John's County in these neighborhoods. I think their focus is on health. That they realize, I think someone on your panel said health equals wealth. I thought you were saying wealth equals health, but I think you could actually interchange those two phrases. Thank you.
Thank you, Joel.
There is that's I think they're all true statements. It does have to take into account things, though. Claire talks about food deserts. It's not just access to healthcare, it's access to the other things that make you healthy. So if you are near a gym, if you are near a
place can afford
where you
to can, right, buy a membership.
If you're near a place where you can get fresh food and you can afford to buy it, you're going to be healthier. If you're the only restaurant nearby is McDonald's and you can only eat the dollar menu.
And you need a car to drive to the grocery store.
Now, I am curious when the Healthy Town project opens up, what that will do to the numbers, because that basically is an attempt to bring in St. John's County sort of people to the urban core.
Here's a tweet. Don't forget also 700 health department jobs have been cut since 2010. Also, lack of insurance is a problem in Duval County. Well, also making news this week, the world's biggest outdoor cocktail party is staying in town. A deal reached to keep the Florida-Georgia game in Jacksonville through at least 2021. This five-year extension should pass the city council. At the same time, Fred, these negotiations took a little while because Florida and Georgia wanted to see how the Jaguars' renovations to Everbank Field club seats might impact stadium capacity.
Well, I mean, that was certainly something that had to be taken into consideration, given the fact that during the Jaguars games, they cover the seats.
Yeah.
And for the Florida-Georgia game, they uncover the seats and add some more. Look, this was certainly a factor in it. But equal to this was the fact of how much money is being poured into the stadium, the accommodations. Once they come back, and with this new addition on the end, you're adding an extra bit of highlight for the Florida-Georgia cocktail party down at the stadium and the shows. How could they resist not coming to the former Gator Bowl for this extravaganza? Huge screens, dancing, singing, all of the parties in one place, and you have a straight corridor down Bay Street. I mean, come on. They had to approve the contract.
And a swimming pool.
Oh,
I mean, co-eds in
grief.
The pool. Great television.
What are you talking about?
Finally, it's our look at the strange, bizarre, and just plain ridiculous from the week around the state. Luckily, we never have a shortage of material. Here it is for you right now, only in Florida. Well, only in Florida do people try to keep alligators as pets. Yes, Mary Thorne of Lakeland says she's upset state officials are making her give up her beloved pet gator, a gentle giant named Rambo, who she says is potty trained, understands sign language, and loves to dress up in costumes. But Rambo's grown too big. Now, Thorne tells the New York Daily News Rambo is like family. There's even a photo of her on the website of the paper riding one of her four-wheelers in costume. But
when he eats this woman, are we allowed to laugh? I mean, is that...
I wasn't going to say that, but I knew you'd help me out there. A recent growth spurt puts 15-year-old Rambo at 6 feet long. Fish and wildlife officials require gators that big to live on properties with at least 2.5 acres of open space. I didn't know that. But since Thorne doesn't have that acreage, Rambo, an indoor gator who rarely goes outside, yes, he lives indoors, he will find a new home very soon.
I love that this isn't even saying you can't have a gator as a pet. It's just saying there are,
you gotta have space.
You've gotta have the space.
That's why we call this only in Florida. Only in Florida do flying baseball bats almost ruin spring training. Dad Sean Cunningham sprang into action last week to save his 8-year-old son Landon from being hit in the face by a flying baseball bat. This was at the Atlanta Braves game against the Pirates in Central Florida. Outfielder Danny Ortiz was up at the plate when the bat slipped from his hands and went flying straight toward little Landon's head. The little boy took a lot of flack in the media because he was sending a photo of Ortiz to his mom on his dad's cell phone right as the bat came flying at him, and he looked like he was too distracted by his phone to get out of the way of the bat.
I do love the victim I love the victim blaming there. Yeah.
I know.
He could have dodged the bat if he wasn't looking at the phone.
Texting while batting, but luckily he was not hurt. Thanks so much, Claire Goforth, Tim Gibbons, Andrew Pantazzi, and Fred Matthews. Thank you so much.
Have a good weekend.
Thank you, Melissa.
Later, the debut of our Friday One Tank Trips, but up next, artist Shanique Smith. Stay with us.
Our new poll is out, as we've been reporting, including the anxiety index. The most anxious among us? What's your guess?
35 to 54 is when people often have children that they're providing for, and they have this looming cliff of impending retirement sort of out there.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. More stories from the Marketplace Edison Research poll coming up next time.
Weekday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Who says you have to be NASA to have a space program? Sculptor Tom Sachs built his own using plywood, steel, and Tyvek wrap.
Lift off in 5, 4, 3, 2, launch commit.
I'm Ira Flatow on Science Friday, staging a do-it-yourself journey to Mars. All on Science Friday from PRI.
Fridays at 2 on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
WJCT's Travel and Entertainment Auction is where you'll find over 300 items, most starting at 75% off at auction.wjct.org. Packages include lodging, attractions, dining, recreation, beauty, and more. Bid now. The auction continues through March 21st at 8 p.m. Log on to auction.wjct.org for more information.
Welcome back. Well, artist Shanique Smith has unveiled some pretty incredible cascading sculptures in the new Project Atrium installation at Museum of Contemporary Art Jacksonville. These signature bundles of tied clothing are hanging in the 40-foot-high atrium gallery against a backdrop of painted calligraphy and a mirrored surface. The overall effect, a thought-provoking visualization about personal identity and individual style. Shanique Smith, good morning. Thanks for being here.
Good morning, Melissa. Thanks for having me.
And this new exhibit is titled Quickening, yes?
Yes.
And that means?
Well, I was thinking of a moment of birth, kind of in a cosmic way, and that word came to me as the burgeoning of something moving forward, things moving faster, energy.
Right. And the energy that you've created by using mainly textiles is really striking. Why did you decide to work with that material for this exhibit?
Well, I've been working with clothing and textiles for the last 15 years, partially because I can use the color that I find that existing within the material, pattern and color from all over, and also because of its connection to our humanity that we share cross-culturally, cross-nationally.
And the overall statement is talking about how with clothes, you know, we put them on, we discard them, we express our very identities, right, through what we're putting on our bodies. Is that part of the message?
It is a part of the message. If I could say that I have a message per se, I think that we cherish things and we have certain objects that we purchase and savor, cherish, you know, they hold our memories and our moral values sometimes.
Yeah, and you grew up with fashion and clothes. Your mom was a fashion designer, magazine editor. So this, you kind of came by this honestly, I guess.
Yeah, I was taken in and out of fabric stores when I was little, and I didn't love fabric then. It wasn't my favorite thing. So I guess I absorbed it by osmosis. And also, I think, you know, my grandmother had fabrics all around, different patterns and things like that. So maybe it's also something, a love of textiles or an appreciation for its craft and aesthetic value could be something that's also inherited through the women in our family.
And what is it about that space? I always ask artists that exhibit in the atrium space at MoCA. It's such a big, soaring space. How does that inspire you, having that big amount of open space to work with for a really large installation?
Well, it is a great opportunity because of the skylights in that space, and also because of it has several vantage points. Usually when you do a large-scale work, you can only see it from the ground. Mm-hmm. But at MoCA, you can see it from the second level and the third level. So you have these different vantage points.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
For me as an artist, I'm considering the entire space.
What's the reaction been once you did the big unveiling? What are some of the most common reactions?
Well, it hasn't necessarily been a big unveiling, okay. More of a gradual progress because it's not like I'm solitary. The museum's open and people are watching me from the beginning, so they're like watching the progress.
Right, so they can watch you work.
Yeah.
Pardon me. So as you work in this space, people need to come and see what you're doing because Quickening will be exhibited for a few months. Luckily, people have a little time to come see it, correct?
Yes, and it's in its completed form.
Is it done yet?
It is finished.
It is open yet. It is open now. And will you be giving any talks or giving any more information out about it?
Yes. Well, tonight is the opening, the members preview, and there is a performance. I've been working with an aerialist here from Bittersweet Studios, Tempest, who will perform in collaboration with the artwork and with music that we've chosen. And tomorrow, on Saturday, I'm giving a talk at 2 with Jamie DeSimone, the curator of my show in the auditorium. So, and that's free to all.
Excellent. So two opportunities both tonight and tomorrow to meet artist Shanique Smith and see the unveiling of her new work, Quickening. It's MoCA's latest Project Atrium installation in their series, MoCA Downtown on Heming Park. Go to mocajacksonville.org for more information. Shanique, thank you.
Thank you.
Still to come, One Tank Trips, ideas for you and places to explore on just one tank of gas. Stay with us.
I'm Al Letson, and I'm hosting a brand new show here on WJCT, and I'm bringing some friends with me.
Aerothang, with Al Letson as the host, and Willie Evans Jr. as the DJ. Well, he's not really a DJ, but he does something.
Every week, we'll be bringing you some stories, some laughs, and something to think about. Sundays at 2 and Wednesdays at 1. Aerothang, it's a new show, because we're going to do Aerothang we want.
Aerothang, the opposite of nothing.
A new debut novel called The Nest looks at adult siblings who can't wait for their inheritance. For the 55-year-old author, the idea of writing a book was not inevitable.
I mean, I did imagine it, but that was like the way I imagined winning an Academy Award.
Talking with a first-time novelist later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Everybody wants to go to heaven, but nobody wants to die.
Loretta Lynn has a new album of new and old songs, co-produced by her daughter Patsy and family friend John Carter Cash. And she's the subject of a new American Masters documentary. On the next Fresh Air, we feature our interview with Loretta Lynn. Join us weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Welcome back. Well, we're debuting a new spring feature on the show in conjunction with UNF as we tell you about interesting and little-known one-tank trips, places you can visit all around the area on just one tank of gas. These stories come to us courtesy of the student journalists at UNF's One Tank Media Project, managing editor Jamie Swan and assistant managing editor Kelly Oates here now to tell us all about their first trip. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. And so the first spotlight we're going to do a one tank trip about is Chiappini's along the banks of Lake Santa Fe in the little town of Melrose, Florida. Tell us about this place.
Oh my gosh, what a unique experience. So Chiappini's is originally a gas station, and there's not, I guess when it was first built, there's not really a whole lot to do in Melrose. And so they turned it into the gas station and watering hole, and it basically has now become just the town's gathering place, and people just go and hang out and spend a day there.
And hang out. It's a corner store, gas station, meeting place, and bar, Kelsey. It's about 40 miles south of Orange Park, so that gives people an idea of where they need to go along State Route 21. What'd you think of it?
It was very unique. It's kind of nice going to a new place where everyone's so close-knit, and when we walked in, rather than giving us the cold shoulder, they embraced us, talked with us, laughed with us. So it's really cool to go to a place and be accepted as one of their own.
And this is a one-stoplight town, Melrose, yeah, Florida.
And Chiappini's is right at the corner of that stoplight. So it one stoplight, and you know the town definitely embraces that attitude, and they seem to love it. They love the idea of such a small town, and everybody knows everybody.
Okay, and Chiappini was a young Army soldier, Joseph Chiappini, who came home from fighting in World War I and founded the town's gas station, bait and tackle shop, grocery store, and bar. This place has been there for 80 years?
Yes.
Is that right?
They celebrated their 80th anniversary last year.
Wow. So again, onetankmedia.com is the site to visit to learn about these interesting one-tank trips. And you have written about this on the website. You've got some other stories on here too, though. Camp Blanding, a cemetery in St. Augustine, the town of Sanderson, Devil's Millhopper, not your average sinkhole. I'm really interested to hear about that one.
Yes, a lot of the stories you wouldn't think that would be so interesting, but once we go there and we talk to the people, it's really awesome to hear their stories and be able to put their stories to life. So,
and the whole idea behind this is that people can visit any of these locations on one tank of gas.
Exactly. Yes, it's a 100-mile radius of Jacksonville, so a little less than one tank, really, but it gets people out of Jacksonville, and even inside Jacksonville, you know, we've got some stories. But
what a fun project.
Yeah, it absolutely has been an amazing experience. I think everybody can agree with that.
Well, they are the very talented student journalists of UNF's One Tank Media Project. Just visit onetankmedia.com to get some ideas for your one tank trips. Thanks so much for being with us, Jamie Swan and Kelsey Oates in studio, and we can't wait to hear about the next one.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
In a moment, how you can learn how to boat for free. We'll tell you how right after this.
Some of them are worthless. Some have infinite value. And some you'll never know how much they are worth until you have to cash them in. On the next Snap Judgment from WNYC and NPR, we proudly present The Promise. Snap Judgment, storytelling with a beat. Do not miss it.
Sundays at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
WJCT and Grassroots Natural Market are accepting submissions from local artists for The Square. The Square is an online venue where artists share their work with the community and compete for a chance to be featured on WJCT TV and radio. Submit now through April 30th. To learn more about The Square and to submit your work, visit wjct.org/thesquare.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup, President Obama names a Supreme Court nominee, Donald Trump warns of riots if Republicans try to block his nomination, and Michigan Governor Rick Snyder testifies on Capitol Hill about the Flint water crisis.
Weekday mornings at 10 on 89.9.
Finally, this hour, well, we are surrounded by waterways here in Northeast Florida. You see boats out there all the time. If you've been driving by and thought, oh gosh, I want to get out on a boat, but I don't know where to start, we've got a solution for you. It's free, too. All this month, Freedom Boat Club is holding free training sessions at Julington Creek for those who want to learn how to boat. CEO Lisa Almeida is here to tell us how this is all happening and how exciting is this. Good morning.
Good morning. We are just really excited about it. We're calling it our new Boater Experience Days. And we wanted to start off during spring break because spring break is next week.
Sure.
A lot of people take off with their kids. So we're doing it next Tuesday and Wednesday. And we have four time slots each day, two boats running, 9 a.m., 11 a.m., 1 p.m., and 3 p.m. You are going to be able to get on the boat, get behind the helm with a licensed Coast Guard captain and learn close quarter docking, you know, how to pull in, safety, driving the boat. You're going to get behind the helm.
Wow. And this is on Tuesday and Wednesday next week, four sessions at Julington Creek Marina on San Jose Boulevard. This is free, yes. But it's first come, first serve.
It is first come, first serve. And we do have some remaining slots available. So if people want to get signed up, they got to call with today and tomorrow because we're probably going to fill up. There's only 32 slots total.
And what kind of boat will people be able to go out on?
So they're going to go on a 20-foot deck boat, brand new bow rider, 150 Yamaha horsepower. Lot of fun. We've done this before at the boat show, and every person that got off said, oh my gosh, that was so much fun. Uh-huh. I can't believe what I learned, and I can't believe what I can do.
And they go right up and down the St. John's River.
Yep, we're going to go right up the St. John's River.
Now, Freedom Boat Club is the world's oldest and largest boat club. You've got members in about half of the U.S. of A states, and it's all about being accessing boating sort of in a club capacity,
yes,
right?
It's called Boating Made Simple. And so it's concierge boating. Show up at the dock. Your boat's ready to go. You go out and have a great time. Give us the keys. No hassle, no maintenance, no headaches, no work. It's all the fun without any of the work.
People always say the best day for boaters is the day they buy the boat and the day they sell the boat. So this is a way to get around that,
yes,
guess.
Yes, it is.
Right?
And we are up to 105 locations across the United States. We got our first location in Canada this week.
Oh, wow.
We made the announcement, so we're really excited about that.
Wow. And so when you do these free days, do people come out that have never been on a boat before?
Yes. We have people that have never driven a boat. And they are going to get behind the helm and they are going to be driving by the end of the session. And it's really cool to see their faces when they get off and they're like, wow, I can do this. Mm-hmm. You know, because a lot of times people just think they don't have the skill sets to do it. They've just never been taught. Uh-huh. And that's what we're going to do.
Now, as you said, four sessions. Should people bring their own food and drinks?
Yeah,
and stuff?
So we just ask them to bring their own water. Sunglasses and sunscreen, because they might be, you know, sometime out in the sun. We've got everything else, all the life jackets, all the safety equipment, all of that is always on our boats. Mm-hmm. And then the captain will be there, and it's only going to be, you know, four people per session, so they're going to get a good amount of time behind the helm and the wheel, and just have a great time and learn some skills.
Can people bring their kids?
No kids, because we have limited access on the boat, and we want to make it a learning time.
And four per boat, so people need to bring their three best friends out. Can they bring alcohol, or is that not so good?
Well, it might, you know, hinder their learning a little bit.
Yeah.
So now they can bring their kids when we do our new boater experience days every month. So on our Facebook page, if they'll like Freedom Boat Club Jacksonville and St. Augustine, every month, once a month, we do new boater experience days where anybody can show up, all their kids, all their family, mom, grandma, and we'll take them for a boat ride.
Wow. Well, it's a free day of learning how to boat. It's coming up, two free days next week. Freedom Boat Club's free new boater experience day events next Tuesday and Wednesday at the Julington Creek Marina on San Jose Boulevard. Go to freedomboatclub.com right now and reserve your slot. It is a free training session if you want to get out on a boat this spring break, and hopefully perfect weather for this. CEO Lisa Almeida, have fun out there.
Oh, thank you so much. Can I give a shout out of a phone number too?
Sure.
904-588-2417. You can text me the day and the time, your name and your email, and we'll get you registered.
All right. Have fun and enjoy boating. Be safe as well.
Yes.
And that's our program. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Sean Birch. The show theme, composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra's Pyotr Chepchik. If you have questions or comments about what you've heard on the show, just send an email to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And make sure to subscribe to the daily podcast, up every day at iTunes and Stitcher. Also, watch the show now, video on demand, at tvjax.com and metrojacksonville.com. Next on Diane Rehm, a look at the week's top national news stories. That's next, and we'll be back Monday at 9 a.m. Have a great weekend.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.